Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the City of Kingston's commitment to a three-year mural creation project.
Residents may see a more colorful Kingston in the coming years as the city embarks on a three-year pilot project to support mural creation in 2025. A report by Jennifer Campbell, the city's Commissioner of Community Services, presented to the Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee, provided an overview as public art policy has changed and developed over the years. Campbell reported ever-increasing interest in public art and murals since policy was officially put in place in 2014, and even more so since amendments were made in spring 2023 to further reduce barriers for artists and simplify the process of installing murals. The report catalogued 16 pieces throughout the city. The city is taking this initiative to beautify Kingston a step further with a pilot project launching next year. In the coming years, the city aims to position Kingston as a center for, quote, creative placemaking, through art that enhances public spaces, celebrates the city's identity, and supports local artists. The city's Director of Arts and Culture Services, Danica Lockhead, explains some of the vision behind this project before the committee.
The report speaks to the pilot project, which is really, you know, a reflection and responding to some of the challenges that we heard from artists in the community, from business owners, from property owners, from community groups who are really excited to do and deliver a mural in the community, but really don't have access to specific resources to support things like artist fees, key services, priming walls, you know, purchasing paint, securing the right materials or equipment for installation. And so the pilot project is going to reallocate and dedicate some existing budget that we have in our public art envelope to really support and hopefully, you know, create more incentives for murals to take place going forward.
As Locke had explained, enhanced services and support for artists will be provided through the project. A total of $150,000 will be allocated to cover costs associated with expanding mural support services. Notably, while previous efforts were exclusively targeting private property, this project will also give artists the opportunity to propose murals on public property. This work is also connected to the city's latest initiatives tackling graffiti, providing more opportunities for creative expression and covering blank surfaces, which have a high risk of being tagged with art. The pilot project will be moving forward in 2025 with unanimous support from the committee. Lockhead had the following closing remarks.
I think if we see larger scale mural projects, there's going to be, you know, a clear demonstration of the benefit of these murals, both in the public realm, but also to the potential business or wherever the mural goes. I think there will be a larger interest in having these murals in place.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Over to Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque's robotic housing project.
Thank you, Jesse. Construction is underway on a unique housing development in Gananoque that uses on-site robotics and is aimed at addressing the affordable housing crisis through innovation and technology. Developed and funded by Horizon Legacy Group as part of the Marco Polo 100 Digital Build Challenge, this project will deliver 26 stacked townhouse units using advanced robotics, automation, and 3D printing technologies integrated with traditional construction methods. The initiative focuses on reducing construction costs to $100 per square foot, providing a model for affordable and sustainable housing. The project has received unanimous approval from the Gananoque Planning Committee and Council. The development features bachelor one-bedroom and two-bedroom units designed to meet diverse housing needs. Horizon Legacy Group will act as the designer, developer, construction manager, owner, and operator of the project. With energy-efficient R30 insulated wall assemblies and all-electric systems, the buildings are designed to reduce energy intensity by 20% and greenhouse gas emissions by 67%, meeting and exceeding Ontario Building Code standards. Proponents say the use of robotics is expected to streamline construction processes, consolidating three trades into one and helping to combat labor shortages. The robotic systems are designed to operate outdoors in Canadian climates, integrating software, hardware, and materials to meet structural and safety requirements. Gananoque Mayor John Beddoes and Leeds and Grenville, Thousand Islands, and Rideau Lakes MPP Steve Clark recently took a site tour. Beddoes also praised the project, saying this is a living experiment that refines and improves the approach to address the challenges of input costs and skilled trade shortages. The project is scheduled to be completed by fall 2025. And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story by LJI reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, about the election of new officials for the Southeast Health Unit.
Thank you, Dinah. The merger of three Eastern Ontario health units to form the new Southeast Health Unit, or SEHU, is now official. More than 550,000 residents will be served by the new organization, which covers a region spanning nearly 20,000 square kilometers. Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington Public Health, Hastings Prince Edward Public Health, and the Leeds, Grenville, and Lanark District Health Unit voted in early December 2024 to merge voluntarily. Board members met online on New Year's Day, January 1, 2025, to elect a chair and vice chair of the amalgamated board, appoint medical officers, and other procedural matters. Jan O'Neill, the former chair of Hastings Prince Edward Board of Health, was elected chair of the SEHU Board of Health. She expressed a strong interest in strengthening public health services and programs to best serve residents across the entire geographic area, with a specific focus on rural demographics. The mayor of the Frontenac Islands, Judy Greenwood Spears, was elected vice chair. Dr. Peter Oglaza will serve as CEO. The SEHU explained that its board consists of four municipal representatives from each of the former public health boards. The board also has six provincial representatives. The Southeast Health Unit noted that its responsibilities are, quote, to provide public health-based programs that help prevent illnesses and injury, promote health and wellness, and protect residents from environmental health hazards. The SEHU has advised that residents continue to interact with their local health office during this transitionary period until otherwise directed.
Thank you to Michelle Dory Forstell for that story. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the potential creation of a hydrogen peaking plant in Loyalist Township.
Public Energy Incorporated is looking at converting the old Kingston Generation Plant in Loyalist Township into North America's first hydrogen peaking plant. This type of plant produces hydrogen at night when energy costs are cheaper and stores it to be sold when it's needed. The company presented council with plans at their year-end meeting and spoke about the benefits of hydrogen. The retired plant is located on Taylor Kidd Boulevard and has access to Lake Ontario. The plan would include an investment of $400 million into Loyalist Township and nearly 130 new jobs brought to the area. Chairman of Public Energy Inc., John Douglas, explains the conversion process and their willingness to rename the facility.
We started looking for a retired gas project that had an interconnection that we could use and basically replace those gas turbines with new 100% hydrogen turbines, which is what we're proposing to do for the Kingston power plant. And we're quite happy to let whoever rename that facility, whether it's Loyalist Generating Station or Loyalist Hydrogen Station.
Douglas spoke about the jobs it could create in the area and noted the interest they've had from large companies.
The thing to keep in mind is we're talking about a $400 million project that will generate 100 construction jobs, probably 15 to 20 great operational jobs for the 30-year life. And this will be the first such hydrogen peaker plant in North America. So we have both GE and Siemens that are pretty keen to be the first.
Douglas notes the unique opportunity Ontario provides.
A common way to make hydrogen is through a chemical process using an electrolyzer. So electrolyzers have been around for a long time. There's nothing new there. But Ontario offers a unique opportunity for this because, of course, at night, our energy, our electricity is pretty cheap. So we're proposing to make hydrogen at night with cheap electricity, like for a penny a kilowatt, and storing that hydrogen on site to burn in a turbine to make electricity when it's required.
Douglas spoke about the support they've received and the steps they'll need to take going forward.
We've spent the past year talking to the Ministry of Energy. We first started with Minister Smith, but now, of course, we have Minister Lecce and his Assistant Deputy Minister Oosterhoff. So they're very familiar with this project. They really like it. So does the Premier. So we have lots of political support. But I think as we've learned from the LT1 exercise, municipal support is critical now. There's all kinds of new regulations from an agricultural perspective on renewable energy brought in by not just the provincial government, but by the federal government. So there's lots of check marks that need to be acquired for a project like this.
Douglas details the history of how he and co-founder Dr. Dennis Stein came up with the plan.
Dennis and I go back a fair ways. So when he came to Canada, we started working together on sort of what's going to be the next big thing. And so we decided that distributed generation will be part of the future. Dennis advised the German government on their energy transition, and people were just starting to talk about that back then. And so we started Public Energy. It's based in Toronto. We're an independent power producer. We own and operate power plants in Ontario, and currently we operate 7 power plants for industrial customers.
Stein talks about the benefits of hydrogen.
It's probably the first molecule that was created in the universe because it's the simplest molecule and it has the highest energy density of everything that we know in our nature. So it's a great energy storage device. And using electricity as an energy form that can be transferred from, as we said, from the grid at night into the hydrogen and back into the electricity, is actually, from the physical perspective, excellent way to advance the power systems in this province. It's really about providing a service that's carbon free, that's sustainable, and that's superior to a battery service, I would say, in that case.
Stein explains the value of the service they propose to offer.
This is not about electricity and energy. This is about the service that this hydrogen can provide to the grid. So the value, we are not buying one set kilowatt hour and then selling it for 10 cents. This is not the case. So we are selling them a service that they can call whenever they want. And that service has a value that goes way beyond kilowatt hour pricing. So it's not really about kind of gaming the 1 cent against 10 cents. It's really about having an equipment that produces that service, and that's the electricity in any given time when they need it, and the rotating mass and inertia and all of that that's coming out of this turbine that has much, much higher value at that given moment in time than ISO requires than a kilowatt hour they can buy on the market. So they have energy markets and then a capacity market. So we are turning energy into the capacity, basically, and selling this as a capacity service.
Douglas explains why a unique situation with power creation in Ontario makes this a good time to consider switching to hydrogen.
People in Canada were talking about, hey, let's make hydrogen to export to Germany, or let's make hydrogen to use for the transportation business. And we came up with a different concept, mostly from Dennis's sort of experience and expertise of, hey, let's make hydrogen with this super cheap energy at night. And sometimes in Ontario, with our nuclear power, we can't turn off our nukes. So we actually pay Americans to take our power. It's bid negative at night, like we'll pay them a penny or sometimes 2 cents to take the energy because we can't afford to turn off a nuke. If you turn off a nuclear reactor, it might take 6 months to turn it back on because you have to go through all this protocol. So that's the unique situation of Ontario and why we think it makes this an incredible opportunity for growth and for investment.
Douglas notes the environmental impact the plant could have.
Companies like Volkswagen and these large global manufacturers, they care about carbon now because their boards are saying they want suppliers that have a low carbon footprint. So by setting up shop in Ontario, they're basically ahead of the game. So we have a green grid. We're going to help green the grid here by a hydrogen peaker plant.
Douglas speaks about the future of the project and its benefits.
We will be looking for municipal resolution of support at some point. What we're talking about is 100% emission-free, a $400 million project that will be one of the first, and a unique opportunity to make it almost like a hydrogen sort of energy center that will attract more interest and could be used as a kind of a center of excellence. We're talking about basically off-the-shelf components used in a new way. That's the innovation that we're proposing.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn noted his interest.
Producing power from hydrogen is kind of intriguing to me, so I've been quite interested in this.
Councillor Paul Proderick noted a potential hang-up in the process.
The emission thing, I think that's unique. The one thing that obviously in the starting stages is some kind of safety plan that's communicated to the community, because I think in past experiences that has been a major roadblock.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Next is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the appointment of Detective Aaron Miller to the position of Abuse Issues Investigator in Prince Edward County.
That is the sound of the Ontario Provincial Police racing to a situation where someone is in danger. It might involve an elderly person who is being abused, or a person who has been violated by their spouse or significant other, yet it could also involve someone with a mental health crisis. Detective Aaron Miller is the newly appointed Detachment Abuse Issues Investigator for the Prince Edward County OPP, who will investigate the incidents for further action to be taken, whether it involves the Alternatives for Women, Community Care for Seniors, or other supportive community partners. The Abuse Investigator position is new for the OPP, and there have been 70 such positions added across Ontario to the various detachments. Their mandate includes, but not specific to, investigating abuse issues, intimate partner violence, sexual abuse, human trafficking, and related issues. Aaron Miller tells us more.
You started a new position. Is this position mandated through the Ontario government?
So as of in and around the tail end of this year, in and around October, the organization got, I believe, 70 of these positions. So most detachments across the province have the abuse issues investigator, and we're lucky enough here in Prince Edward to have one of those spots.
And can you tell me about the position?
There are a number of job functions that I'm responsible for, but I'll focus on three of the main ones. The big one, arguably the biggest, is overseeing all things intimate partner violence investigations. So if somebody reports a domestic occurrence today, an officer will respond to it, and then it's my job to go through that occurrence and review it to ensure that everything, all the victim supports have been put in place. Whether it's a criminal code domestic or not, sort of guides the investigation, and what I look at is somewhat dependent on that. So that's a big portion of it, to make sure that the victim safety concerns are certainly covered off afterwards as well. Timely review of all things abuse issues is part of the job function as well. So not only intimate partner violence, but all things human trafficking, child abuse, and then especially in our community, elder abuse. So as we know, the demographic in Prince Edward is what it is. And elder abuse is an interesting one, because if you talk to our partners at Community Care for Seniors, they would tell you that often in an elder abuse case, it's difficult for that person to report because they might be so dependent on their abuser, which is no different than an intimate partner violence situation. But When we look at the demographics, you see the average age of Prince Edward, and our fear is many of these occurrences go, like anything else, go unreported. So that's one of the challenges for all things elder abuse. And then the third point that I wanted to talk about is building and maintaining community relationships. So organizations that we directly work with, for example, VWAP, Victim Services, Community Care for Seniors, of course, Alternatives for Women, we've realized, and we have realized this for some time, we're not going to be able to police ourselves out of a lot of these abuse issues. So we need our community partners. And we're very lucky here in Prince Edward. We have great relationships with a lot of the organizations. And we often, especially I will often call them to say, what should I do here? Or what can I do here? What supports and services should I be offering? So that's the fantastic piece, or the luxury that we have here in the county. And part of the position, it's an interesting position because there is still some investigative, there's an investigative aspect to the position, whether it's following up with witnesses, victims, writing warrants sometimes. So there's lots to it, and I'm excited to be in the role.
There's special training involved.
We're lucky with the OPP. There's always training opportunities and courses coming out. If we have an interest in an area, luckily the organization is great. The courses are endless. So if that's something of interest, they'll send us on that. But all of my positions had training at the very beginning. We had presentations from a variety of units within the OPP and then experts in the field external to the OPP as well.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the local journalism initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the Tammy's Jammies charity initiative in Northumberland County.
A group of volunteers in Northumberland County and Belleville have distributed nearly 2,800 new pairs of pajamas to children in foster or social services care just before Christmas. Tammy's Jammies was started 8 years ago by Tammy Staples, who says she gave her newly adopted son a new pair of pajamas on Christmas Eve. This was a family tradition for Staples and her family growing up. Staples and volunteer Jerry Seabarth spoke to me about the success and expansion of Tammy's Jammies.
A lot of hard work, a lot of sweat and tears, and I'm going to tell you, a lot of support. And it takes a team, and it takes like I always say, it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a team to provide for a child.
What were your thoughts when you saw that level of pajamas coming in?
I don't usually get the numbers. Usually what happens is it's a huge surprise to me as well. Usually Jerry keeps all the numbers and keeps tally of everything. He's more the back person. He organizes, helps control things, make sure things go smoothly. I'm more the upfront, the face person, and the social butterfly of the crew.
So this has been going on for about 8 years now.
Yeah.
Just walk me through kind of how this started and to how it's expanded this to this year.
So originally it started just after my son was adopted. And we usually do the tradition, and we have as kids, my sisters and I, always got one gift on Christmas Eve to open, and it was always a brand new pair of jammies. That was mine, or ours. And we got to open them, and the snuggle, the cuddle, the whole feel of knowing that that's my gift on Christmas Eve and waking up Christmas morning with a brand new pair of jammies. So when my son was adopted, we did the same tradition with my son. And when my son was in care for the adoption, we did the same thing. We want to make sure that all kids have the same and wake up with a brand new pair of jammies and go to bed Christmas Eve with those jammies and wake up knowing that they're theirs.
From what I understand, this kind of expanded into the Belleville region, not only Northumberland County, but Belleville.
This is the first year we've actually went to Belleville. We've never been with Belleville before. This was, okay, so last year we raised 2,103 pair of pajamas. And how do we build on that? And building on it, we're counting on a lot of people that are in our home area, whether it's Coburg, Port Hope, in this vicinity, and we're counting on them to to keep us where we were, but to get bigger, how do we do that? And you've only got 17,000 people in Port Hope, so the expansion was to go to Belleville and hopefully all the places in between, because it goes to Belleville and Highland Shores basically goes from, you know, Port Hope to Belleville, north of Peterborough. So that big vicinity that we have there, we're trying to make sure we can keep building on that. So this year we decided, we talked to Belleville. Tammy went to the Belleville police, got them on board, and the foundation's based out of Belleville. So it kind of just goes hand in hand with everything we're doing.
Now, just to back up a bit here, Jerry, from what I understand, the pajamas go to children in hospitals, care. How is the program distributed for children?
Until now, it's always been with the Children's Foundation, whether kids are in care with the Children's Aid, whether it's the foster families, whatever that is, any child in care that needs them goes through the foundation, and they distribute those to those people. This year, with the amount we had, it's expanded to requests from the Belleville Hospital, from probably seven or eight, not companies, but seven or eight requirements from here to Belleville that have asked for help for the kids this year, whether it's been, you know, and to us, really, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, Billy Bob or it's if who it is. It's a matter of getting that child those pajamas, and that's the whole thing we're doing here. It doesn't matter where the child's from. It doesn't matter who he is or she. It's just a matter of getting those children into a new pair of pajamas on Christmas Eve.
Now, Jerry, in terms of logistics on how you get the whole distribution, walk us through how you process 27, almost 2,800 pairs of jammies.
We have our own little area that we pick up our stuff. We have a girl, Cindy, who works with us, who does a lot of traveling out and picking up boxes. We bring the boxes back to our garage, and what we do there is we stockpile for about a week at a time, and then we have people, volunteers, come in, and they help sort them, distribute them for, get them ready for distribution, down to the Children's Foundation, who come about once a week and pick them up. We need to count them, and we need to sort them. So whether you're one of these people that come out and donate a pair of pajamas, whether you've decided this year you wanted to give us some financial support that we can put in and buy pajamas with, or whether you're organizing, counting, it doesn't matter what you're doing. We need everybody, and we need them all there to help. And that's how we get it done, is with all these people helping us.
Okay, Tammy, in terms of what you've been hearing from children, parents, the foster care system, what has been the reaction of children receiving these jammies?
We actually get notified that they're been provided to the children. We hear lots of great things from foster parents that they're being given away to kids in care, and kids who are underneath the CAS care themselves. So I'm going to say I think the feedback has always been fantastic. Like, you know, they're getting something that's theirs. They're not going to be with their family or whoever they're not going to be with at Christmas time, then at least they can have a gift that's theirs. So, and like I said, this started back at, first off with the Port Hope Police Jammy Drive, and it's been nicknamed, Tammy's Jammies along the way, kind of has a ring to it. And honestly, it doesn't matter. It's a teamwork. It's a partnership that makes this all happen. From 50 pairs of jammies the first year to 2,780 jammies is incredible. And like I said, it takes a whole community and surrounding communities to make this all happen. And, you know, our hope is that the expansion, like I've connected with Belleville Police and spoke to Sherry Minks, makes there, and she's put it out there at the station, and you know, hopefully next year we'll get on board with Peterborough Police. That's a good hope, you know, fingers crossed on that one, and you know, it'll be all over, and you know, those jammies will go up and help the children up in that area. That's all it is. It's just us giving and making sure that, you know, the children receive.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that report. Next up is Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 9th, we are going to see a daytime high of -8 with a 30% chance of flurries dropping down to -12 overnight. Friday, January 10th, high of -4. It'll be cloudy. We'll see a drop of about 7 degrees to -11 overnight. Saturday, January 11th, daytime high of -5 with a 40% chance of snow dropping down to -9 overnight. And Sunday, January 12th, we're going to see a daytime high of -3 and it will be cloudy. Monday, January 13th, we'll see a high of -5 dropping down to -10 overnight. And Tuesday, January 14th, a high of -8 with an overnight low of -11.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. We'll